Okay, let's get started. There's all these polite potential students waiting outside. You're going to have to be much more aggressive if you're going to be an LSE student. Okay? Won't fit in if you're that polite. My name's Ron Alvandi. I teach in the International History Department. I've never done this before. I only became the undergraduate admissions tutor this year, so bear with me. My job, basically, as far as admissions is concerned, we don't do admissions within the department, so I don't sit there and read hundreds of applications and decide who gets in and who doesn't. Thank God there are some bureaucrats in the central administration that do all of that. But I sort of tell them what we're looking for in potential students and how to pick and choose between the applications. And so that's what I want to tell you, basically. I want to give you the inside track on what we're looking for, what a typical LSE international history student looks like, and to give you a sense of what we do in the department and how history at LSE is a bit different to the way history is done at other major sort of British universities. Okay. To tell you a bit about myself, I don't want to talk a great length about myself, but it gives you a sense of what kind of person you're going to find teaching you in the International History Department. So I'm from Iran. I lived in Australia, in the US, and now in the UK, and I never intended to be a historian. I was working as a diplomat. I worked at the United Nations for a long time, and I got sick of being a civil servant, and then I did a PhD and became a historian. We do have very traditional sort of historians in my department, many of my colleagues who went straight the way through and have been historians all their life, but we also have people who've done all kinds of other things, including sort of policy relevant things in government and international organizations, and you'll get a sense that we are a very sort of, we're not a very sort of ivory tower department. We're very much engaged, we're very much policy oriented, and very modern. So, what should you expect? Well, when you're going from A levels to university, and especially when you're coming to a place like the LSE, it does involve a real sort of change in mindset. And we see this in the first year students. At the A levels, you're memorizing information, it's set curriculums, you're given a set of information, you digest it, and you kind of repeat it in an exam. Okay? That's not at all what we do here. Our teaching is research driven. So the people teach courses on subjects in which they are leading international scholars of. So, for example, I work on the history of the Middle East, especially the Persian Gulf region, and that's what I teach. And I don't have to go and teach stuff I don't know anything about. I teach that, and the same goes for the rest of my colleagues. And that's fairly unique within a university system, to have people teaching you courses on subjects in which they are actually the leading scholars in that field. Yeah. What we basically do is not give you a bunch of information and expect you to memorize it. We essentially help you to navigate a huge ocean of knowledge, endless libraries, vast amounts of books have been written on any historical stuff. So we help you navigate all of that and to come to your own conclusions and to form your own opinions. What we're trying to do is to help you understand what's valuable, what's important, and what's unimportant, and to teach you to be critical about what you read, to be able to then form your own arguments, construct your own historical arguments, weigh evidence, things like that. Yeah, it's a different kind of mindset. Yeah. essentially what we want you to do is to learn how to not have the right answers, but how to ask the right questions. Yeah. And it's difficult. It's very difficult, but it's a lot of fun. So there's a kind of, in most British universities, there's a kind of traditional history, and basically what you will get is a lot of British history and a lot of European history. It kind of revolves around this idea of history as sort of telling the story of the nation, right? So who are we as the British? You know, where did we come from? It's that kind of thing which you would get. You would probably do a lot of medieval history, you know, churches and pilgrims and that sort of thing. And you'd probably do quite a lot of stuff on Europe and how, you know, the sovereign states of Europe emerged after 1648 and all that sort of thing. So just to give you an example, I mean, if you look at all the debates that are going on right now about the First World War, so it's the big anniversary of the start of the First World War, it's a centenary this year, and you know, if you look around you and see the kind of debates that are going on, they're all about basically the same debates about war guilt, you know, which nation was responsible for the war, basically, and was it a foolish war or not, and it's very much sort of national histories. Britain and the First World War, the Germans and the First... That's not the sort of thing that we do here. Yeah, we try to step outside of that strictly national context and to have a really global view of history. And that's why it's called international history. Yeah, but I'll tell you more about that in a minute. So, history at LSE is not just British history and it's not just European history. It's international history. Now, what does that mean? It means basically that we do the history of the whole world. It includes history of particular nations, and it includes European and British history, but we also cover Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Middle East. We don't do Antarctica yet, but we're still looking for someone. The basic philosophy behind that is that you can't really understand any history without looking at at least at its international context. Nations are not sort of hermetically sealed boxes where there's no movement across borders. Actually, it's quite the opposite. In terms of any aspect of history you look at, whether it's trade, commerce, war, ideas, culture, migration, it's all international in some way, shape, or form. So that's the way we approach things. For example, I work on Iran mostly, but I look at it from an international perspective. Iran's relations with other countries, how ideas from outside of Iran influence the Iranians, that sort of thing. You know. Now, if you come to an international history department like ours, what does that give you the opportunity to do? Well, you will look at the history of international relations, which is where our sort of department started, what used to be called diplomatic history, basically. So that's the history of relations between states. You could take courses on early modern international history in Europe. You could look at the rise and fall of communism in Central and Eastern Europe. You could look at the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, or, I don't know, the Persian Gulf War in 1991, the struggle for independence amongst colonies in Asia and Africa. You name it. That is the more sort of traditional international history, and most of us in the department do that sort of thing, but that's not all we do. We also look at things like globalization, look at the forces that are shaping the world. We look at, for example, the history of revolutions. Yeah, so how revolutionary ideas moved around the world and how they impacted different societies, everything from 1917 Russian Revolution to 1949 Chinese Revolution to 1979 Iranian Revolution. We look at processes of integration and disintegration. So, for example, I have one colleague who works on the formation of the Ottoman Empire or the Mughal Empire in South Asia, whereas others look at, for example, the disintegration of the Soviet Union or European integration, in the Cold War period. So that's kind of what we do. So the bottom line is, what can't you do here? Well, you wouldn't be able to come here and do all of your courses focusing on a particular country or a particular continent. That would be very difficult. Yeah. We've structured it in such a way that you come out with a kind of global understanding of history. I get a lot of sort of applications where people have a sort of obsession with one particular country or one particular region. Think very carefully about that. We might not be the best place for you if you just want to study, China for 3 years. So history at LSE is international. History at LSE is also modern. Okay, now modern means one thing to historians and it means another thing to everybody else, okay? So when historians talk about modern, what they mean is basically roughly everything from about the 16th century onwards. Right. In other words, the period in which, the post-Enlightenment, post-Renaissance period when we saw the creation of nation-states, essentially. Yeah. Stuff mainly, the British and the French kind of got on with it before everyone else. But now that means that, for example, we don't teach any courses on ancient history. We don't teach anything on medieval history. And that's quite different. If you were to go to other institutions, Oxford or Cambridge or, UCL, they do that sort of thing. But we don't. We do teach early modern history. I have a number of colleagues who work on, as I mentioned, the Islamic world and also early modern Europe, 17th, 18th century. But that's about as far back as we go. We don't do ancient history. That's not to say that we don't look at the ideas that came from the ancient world and how they shaped the modern world. Yeah, it's not to say we're completely uninterested. In Greece and Rome and Persia and Egypt, we are, but we don't teach courses on it. Keep that in mind. A lot of the courses we teach actually run all the way up to the present day. Right, so it's not uncommon that you would take a course that starts in, 19th century or something, and spans the entire period until 2010. Right. And the idea behind that is that we're trying to teach history as prologue. We're trying to talk about history in a way that's relevant and connects to the world today and the problems we have in the world today, and to give you a context for discussing things that are going on, right? Rather than just some abstract discussion that's completely disconnected from what happens in the world. For example, I teach a course on the international history of the Persian Gulf. I start in... that one starts in the sort of interwar period, 1930s, 1940s, and it runs till the war in Iraq in 2003. Yeah. And I try to... what we try to do is to understand how Anglo-American intervention in the region has ebbed and flowed and changed throughout the course of the second half of the 20th century, to give students a context and an understanding of what's going on in the region today that's historically grounded. I hope that all makes sense. Let me just stop and just see if there are any questions about that. International history, modern history. Are you clear on what all that means? Yeah? Please feel free to ask if you... No? Okay. So, what's it like to study history here? History is actually split in the LSE because of the way that the department's formed since basically the First World War. History is split between various departments. We are the sort of main history department, the international history department, but the LSE also has an economic history department. And in the government department, there are actually quite a number of historians that work on history of nationalism. And there's opportunities for you to take courses in all those departments and sample as you wish. We offer 2-degree programs, the BA History and the BSc in International Relations and History. They're both run by the International History Department, but the IR and History degree allows you to is a joint honors degree which we run, but allows you to take I think up to half of your courses in the IR department. Now, the degree structures are very open. We have very, very, very few compulsory courses of any kind. You are basically allowed to pick and choose and shape the degree in almost whatever way that you like. Because we want you to make decisions about your own education. We don't want to make all the decisions for you. And also, students tend to enjoy and do much better at courses that they want to do rather than courses that we're forcing them to do. Obviously, we'll give you advice. You'll have an academic advisor that will help you pick and choose courses. But in general, what can I tell you? I mean, probably a lot of people will tell you LSE students are very demanding. They're very precocious. They're very ambitious. They are pretty driven people. We want to accommodate that kind of person. We want to give them the opportunity to shape their education and make of it what they want. We don't offer any half-unit courses, so all of our courses run for 22 weeks across the whole year, the whole academic year, which means that you will go into quite a lot of depth in that course. You'll get quite a broad and deep understanding of that topic. That's a bit unusual at the LSE. A lot of the other departments have sort of these 10-week half-unit courses. We don't do that. A typical course will involve writing 2 to 4 essays, and you'll have to probably lead a group discussion at some point, doing a presentation. So we try to basically develop your written skills, your essay writing skills, your oral presentation skills, and your critical thinking. The assessment is varied. Some of the courses are assessed solely based on a final exam. Some of them are a combination of an exam and essays. Some of them even have sort of more innovative assessment structures, group work exercises, class contribution marks, that sort of thing. You can take up to 3 outside options. So you could take, I don't know, law course or a government course or anything you like, basically. You're not just limited to the LSE either. You can take, even though we're now independent of the University of London, you could take courses throughout the University of London system. Our department is, I would say, consistently ranked in the top 3 or 4 in the country, probably the top 6 or 7 in the world. You will be surprised at how much interaction, even as an undergraduate, you will have directly face-to-face with some of my colleagues who are the very big names in their field. All of us teach one undergraduate course and one graduate level course. all of us have direct interaction with students. All of us mark essays. All of us have office hours. It's a slightly unusual thing, but we do it on purpose because we know that's what students want, and we also derive a great deal of satisfaction from it. And the net result of that is that in the National Student Survey, we have the highest student satisfaction rating in the country of any history department, and we actually have the highest student satisfaction rating of any department in the LSE. And we're quite proud of that, and we work very hard to maintain that by making sure that our students are happy, that we give them as much feedback as we can, and we interact with them as much as possible, and basically we take them seriously. You know, something else that I'm sure many of you are thinking about, and I'm sure your parents are thinking about, is employment prospects. You'll be happy to know that LSE has the highest success rate in terms of employment 6 months after graduation, and certainly our department has the highest rating for any history department in the country. And I think that has to do with the fact that we are a modern international history department, and that we engage with issues in the real world, and that we talk about policy rather than just, you know, being detached an ivory tower. So, what else? Now, I suppose I should talk about admissions. What do you need to get in? Well, all of that information is on the website, but just to reiterate, you need to get the grades, obviously. We put a lot of stock in the results, and it is very competitive. But besides the grades, we look very, very, very closely at the UCAS statement. Yeah. So really pay very close attention to that UCAS statement. It is what separates students out, you know. We want to see that you know what history at the university level entails, and what history and international relations entails. Yeah. In other words, what the difference would be between studying history at LSE or international history rather than studying it somewhere else. Yeah. And why you would be a good fit for our department. Yeah. We want to know what kind of history you're interested in. Is it modern? Is it international? Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, I don't know, if you are really interested in ancient history, or you've done that at A-levels, or you're interested in the Tudors or whatever, that we wouldn't be interested in you. But we'd like to see how what you've studied has shaped your ideas about history, and how you might apply those ideas to the modern international period. We want to see that you're asking the right questions, right? So to give you, I get all these UCAS statements, for example. I see them all the time where people will write, you know, I read Niall Ferguson's book about the West and the rest, and it was great, and I loved it, and so and that's fine, but it doesn't really tell me very much about you. I want to know why you found it interesting. I want to know what drew you to it. I'd like to know what you thought the limitations of it were. I'd like to see that you're engaging with what you've read and the history that you've encountered in some kind of critical way, you know. So pay close attention to that in your UCAS statements. Finally, before you decide where to study, whether it's here or anywhere else, you know, ask the right questions about uni. You know, ask yourself what kind of history you're interested in. Ask yourself what kind of degree structure you want, how much flexibility you want in the degree, and ask yourself what you want to do with this degree after you're done. You know, what kind of person do you want to be you know, when you come out the other end. And believe me, you'll be a different person. you think about these things and write about them in your UCAS statement. Yeah, show us that you're a reflective, contemplative type of person. Yeah, and it will help you sort of stand out from the crowd. Anyway, I'm going to stop there so that we have plenty of time to answer your questions, because I'm sure there's lots that I haven't covered. So please, ask anything you like. Those of you who are standing, there's some seats up here if you want to come and sit down. Please. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the course is question weeks. And this morning, we were talking about 3 10-week terms. The remaining 8 weeks work out how?
So, most of the teaching is done in the autumn and the spring terms, what we call the Michaelmas and... Lent term, Michaelmas and Lent. And then we have a third term, which is the summer term. And in the summer term, normally we have 2 weeks of revision classes in the first 2 weeks of summer term. And then the remaining 8 weeks, it's not quite 8 weeks, but 8 weeks is for revision, for exams. So we are all here, we're all on campus, we all have office hours, students can come and see us, but the period is mainly for revision. Now, it's not... It depends which year of the degree program you're in, because say for example you're doing the BA History, in your third degree you have to do a dissertation. You have to do a 10,000 word dissertation, and most students write that up in the summer period. So that's how the term structure works here. There is some talk of that the term structure might change slightly, but it hasn't gone through all the committees and structures yet, but I think roughly it'll be probably the same. Yeah. Please. How sorry? So you take it as one of your courses, so you do it throughout the year. The one thing to keep in mind, though, if you're doing outside options, we're happy for you to do that, and we'll give you permission to do it. But it depends on the other department, you know, agreeing to let you into their courses, and there's a bit of jockeying and competition that goes on. So if it's it's a very popular course in the law department, it might be that they give preference to their own students. Okay, so keep that in mind. But normally it works out okay, because, you know, they all want to get into our courses as well, so it's a bit of reciprocity that goes on. Yeah. Yes?
And how do you juggle doing courses on that?
How do you juggle, sorry?
Are you doing a course at SOAS or something like that? How does that work?
As your outside option? It's not too bad. I mean, SOAS, 10-minute walk from here, Russell Square, so I go there all the time because they've got a fantastic library on Middle East, you know. It's very common. A lot of students do take language courses at SOAS, you know, because we have a language center, but there's some really kind of specialized, less popular languages that only they offer. So it usually works out fine. Yeah.
How does the Bachelor of Science as well, International Relations and History, differ from the Bachelor of Arts?
Okay. So if you take, let me, actually, that reminds me. There's a handout here that has the degree structures on it. Basically, the difference is that if you do the BSc in IR and History, there are a certain number of compulsory IR courses that you have to do in every year, which the IR department stipulated. So, very few. I mean, it's not really very restrictive. It's only one, or I think it's one or two. But you have somewhat less flexibility in terms of the choices, in terms of the courses you can make. But doing the dissertation is optional for BSc, IR, and History students. It's compulsory for BA History students, but we do have a lot of IR and History students that do the dissertation anyway. But it's optional. Yes?
Well,
what do you think the prospects do
have studying international relations and history? So there's the UN.
Yeah. It's... I don't think there's a huge difference
in terms of whether you do the history or the IR in history, in terms of the employment prospects. They all go on to do pretty similar things, and they do all kinds of things. You know, I have former students that do the more what you would imagine, you know, FCO, Foreign Office, you know, UN, Cabinet Office, places like that. They work for foreign governments and all kinds of places. But then, you know, I also have students that do, you know, have set up their own NGOs, who do, I mean, all kinds of stuff. I have one former student who's an artist, you know. Basically, I think if you're coming out of the LS, if you're coming out with an LSE degree, you have a lot of options, you know, and you're a very hot commodity, basically. A lot of our students also go on to do further study. You know, they go on and do master's degrees and PhDs and so on. But, you know, I think it's something like 94%, if I'm not mistaken. You know, I basically have a job within 6 months. So, the key with that is basically not to be too... to take some risks, you know. When you've got an LSE degree in your pocket and you're young, you know, you can afford to go out into the world and try something and do something, and which you won't be able to do later in life, you know, when you've got more responsibilities and so on and so forth. So it's fantastic, you know. They go on and do almost anything you can imagine. But yeah, but a lot of them are in the more traditional, the law, politics, media, journalists, you know, stuff like that. Yeah. Get a few in the banking and consulting world too. Try not to encourage too much of that. Yes, please.
Are there any requirements, like getting first in every single year for you to carry on to do a master's?
There's no requirement as such.
I know Cambridge, they expect three first to get into their master's course.
If you're talking about the master's courses in our department, it depends. We have different master's programs, and they all have slightly different entry requirements. But generally, we're looking for someone who ends up with a good 2-1 degree at least. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
How many contact hours do you get? Did you say per week?
In a typical course. So no, you probably have 2 hours. So if it's a second or third year course, you probably have a 2-hour seminar every week, and the, whoever teaches the class, we have 2 hours of office hours as well, which you would welcome to go to. That's about normal, I would say. Some of the courses are slightly different in that they are a combination of lecture and seminar. I mean, you still have contact with the staff, but it's somewhat different. Yes?
How big are the seminars?
They are capped at 15 students. Yeah, we don't allow more than that. I mean, occasionally we have 16, but usually they're no more than 15. Actually, often they're quite a bit less than that. I have a class this year, undergraduate class, it's 8 students, which is great, because I get to know them, you know, we do all kinds of cool stuff, we go to dinners, we go to the British Museum, and it's much more rewarding for us if the class size is small, because then we can get a bit better feedback, and we can get to know the students. Yes?
How many courses do you take a year?
You take 4 courses a year. Yes?
In the first students do, they know it's particular time period really well, but it's sort of time period. Or would you prefer a student that focus on, say, 2 seminars and not as well?
I wouldn't mind. You know, I don't think it makes any difference, really. Rather than their sort of, you know, whether they're interested in this century or that, what we're really looking for is that they understand what we have to offer, and that what we have to offer connects with what they're interested in. That's important. And that they are a sort of reflective and critical person. So rather than just reading a book and then summarizing what the book was about,
they tell me what they found interesting about it, what they were impressed by, what they were convinced by, what they were unconvinced by, what the limitations were, that sort of thing. At the end of the day, it's all about that critical thinking.
Yes, sir. In the first year, you touched on the four topics, and then in the second year, you touched on those again on the four topics.
In the first year, sorry, I couldn't hear you.
In the first year, you said four topics. You touched on those again in the second year, or did you have the intention of thinking what you're learning about?
You don't have to change completely. So, most of the first year courses, the big ones, like HY113, which is the history of the extra-European world, the way they're structured is that various members of the department give the lectures based on the areas in which they are experts. So, for example, my colleague Anthony Best gives three lectures on East Asia, which he knows very well. My colleague Tanya Hama does the lectures on Latin America. I do three on the Middle East. Gianna Lewis does three on Africa. So you get a little taste of basically the kind of international history that everyone does based in different regions of the world. And then in the second and third year, you can, if you say you took that course and you were particularly interested in Africa, and you found, you could take Joanna's course and go into much more depth. It's kind of structured like that. But there are also, if you take HY116, for example, which is named about Europe, basically, there are also second and third year courses that flow on from that, looking at early modern Russian history, or Alan Skate's course on Austria, on the Reichs, So they are all connected. But the idea in the first year is just to kind of give you a sample of everything and give you a basic grounding in a broad world history. And then in the second and third year, then you just focus a bit more on go to
the depth. Do you provide a bit more effective types of courses? Or would you just go for the ones that you're interested in?
I would have. Go for the ones that interest you. Go for whatever you find intriguing. But my best advice to you in choosing courses and everything in life is go beyond your comfort zone. Don't just go for what's easy and what you think you do well at. Pick something that is going to push you a little bit. And broaden your knowledge and broaden your understanding. Yes?
You mentioned earlier about sort of the presentation to your classmates and stuff. Would they be on set topics, or would you pick up topics?
It depends on the course, but normally, so there'll be sort of 20 topics, and you'll pick, and you'll be asked to do a presentation on one of them. You'll lead the discussion, basically, on that. But as far as a kind of specific question, I think there's always room for students to pick and choose what they like. But it does depend on the course. Yes?
Apart from being effective and driven and being able to do critical thinking, what other personality traits or skills would you look for with those perspectives to?
You have to imagine, imagine you're going to spend 20 weeks with someone. What kind of person would you like to spend 20 weeks with? I have fantastic students. They amaze me. I have students that come to my office hours and say, I just read this book, it's incredible, what do you think of this? And we'll sit and have a discussion, and it's fantastic. I have other students that all they want to know is, how do I get first? How do I get the top of it? And they're less interesting. What I'm always looking for is just curious people. Curious people who can think critically and are reflective. And understand what an amazing opportunity it is for 3 years to come here and read and write and meet all these people and learn and grow. It's a unique, opportunity, unique part of your life. And if you spend that whole 3 years just focused on grades and getting a job or whatever, you'll miss
point of being here.
Yes?
And in terms of the admissions process, would you have to sit an aptitude test?
Would you have to sit an aptitude test? I don't think so. No. We just look at your A-level results or baccalaureate results or whatever it is and your UCAS statement. Sorry.
Would you do interviews after?
No, we don't do interviews.
Is there any sort of what's the department's opinion on gap years and deferred entry?
It's no problem at all. But I want to know what you did in your gap year.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, and you mustn't think that it's sort of like, oh, you know, like, we're going to give preference to this person that went, you know, on this exotic tour of. And that's great if you did that, and I'd love to hear about that. But I also understand there are people who spend their gap year working to earn money, you know. And maybe in their spare time they read, maybe they learned something from doing that job. Whatever it is you did, tell me a bit about it. Because they're looking for a sense of your personality and who you are and what we can expect. You know?
You said that there were 2 hours office time.
Yes.
What are the students expected to do after
an
audition?
What are they expected to do? They're expected to study very, very hard in this. You know, if you have time, well, it's out of turn now. But if you have time, go to the library and just have a look around. And you will see every single desk is taken. You know, it's hard work. It really is hard work. I think probably my students spend on, you know, for every hour that they're in the class with me, they probably spend, I would think, 5 or 6 hours on their own studying for that 1 hour. You know, so it's hard work, but it's most of the learning that goes on is not in the classroom. You know, most of the learning that actually goes on is with you sitting somewhere, writing, reading, thinking critically, and then coming back to us and saying, look, this is what I found, and then we guide you and tell you, you know, go a little bit this direction, go in that direction, and we give you feedback. But you'll find that a lot of it is self-driven. And that's the nature of that. That goes for any university, really, not just here.
So do you give them, for example, an essay title and your work?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So the way I do it, for example, is we have seminars every week in my course, and we'll have 2 or 3 seminar questions, you know. And I'll say, you go and read this stuff, and as you're reading, ask these questions, and tell me what you think the answer is to these questions. You know, come, and then they come, and then I really don't have to do very much. I just sort of sit there, and they get in big arguments with each other and debate, and it's great, and I sit down and watch. And when they get a bit off track, I drag them back to what I think they should be talking about. That's how it ideal. Yes?
Do you
know,
actually,
what
is your
fear
that you don't have a chance of getting
into the I wouldn't say you don't have a chance. We look at your A-level results and your UCAS statement and we weigh them. And we have taken people who maybe didn't perform as exceptionally, you know, as others. But the grades are very important, because, you know, they are our best indication of your academic ability.